This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and it's time for our monthly EcoMyths segment. EcoMyths, the website that makes it easy to be green, and we're going to bust a myth today about marmots. Kate Sackman is here with me. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Jerome.
So what are we dealing with here?
Well, you know, off and on, we've been doing a global warming series, and today we want to talk about whether global warming is meaningful to marmots, which is a biggish family, which we're going to learn about.
Now, a lot of people have never seen a marmot, I don't think, you know, unless they go up in the mountains or find a marmot. But we have a close relative in the area. And with us is Stephen Sullivan, a senior curator of urban ecology here at the Chicago Academy of Sciences, the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. Nice to meet you.
You too.
And you actually brought a ground squirrel with you. It is a stuffed ground squirrel and is peering at me on the table. But that is a pretty close relative of the marmot, eh?
Yeah, well, squirrels are actually a pretty big family. And as I like to say, the Chicagoland region is very squirreliferous. We have a variety of squirrel species, including tree squirrels like the gray squirrel and fox squirrel that you might see in your neighborhoods. We also have squirrels such as the chipmunk, the eastern chipmunk, and things that are less commonly seen like the Franklin's ground squirrel, the 13-lined ground squirrel, and the groundhog. The groundhog is actually a squirrel species. It's one of the largest squirrel species that we have in the United States. And the groundhog is a kind of marmot. There are six species of marmots, and this is the one that occurs in our region.
And so a groundhog is like a squirrel that lives in the ground. So does that mean it is a hibernator? And I mean, squirrels, my squirrels live in trees. I see them. They'd freeze to death if they were hibernating.
Well, that's a really good point. Tree squirrels don't hibernate. And so the gray squirrel and fox squirrel that live in your neighborhood, they're going to be active 365 days a year. But ground squirrels like the groundhog, as well as things like chipmunks, do hibernate during our winter.
And so they're going in their hole, they're digging in, and it sounds like it's a pretty remarkable hibernation.
Hibernation is physiologically just this amazing phenomenon where you go from this little warm-blooded animal that's scampering around all summer long to something that is nearly frozen solid. Its heart beats almost not at all, and it breathes even less than that.
That is truly amazing. And I did look around on the web for something about this, and there was a BBC little three-minute thing that they had on marmots hibernating, and they had them coming out all wobbly and laying on a rock for a long time. And we put it up on our Facebook page at WBEZ Worldview, and people can check out a wobbly little marmot there. Now, why don't we bring in a marmot expert here to weave in how we're doing on climate change with marmots. Daniel Bloomstein is a professor and chair of the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Department at UCLA, and he leads the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab Marmot Project. Thanks very much for joining us, Professor Bloomstein.
Thanks for having me.
Kate, take it away.
So, Dan, thank you for joining us. We're very interested in learning what's happening during hibernation and how is that impacted by climate change?
Hibernation, as Stephen was just saying, is fascinating. We've actually hibernated, borrowed animals from the field and brought them into the lab, hibernated them, then put them back out in the field because we try to study these animals throughout their lives without hurting them. And picking up a hibernating marmot, it feels like a fuzzy rock. It's cold, and it's piloerect, its hair's up, and it feels sort of pinprickly.
And, is that ethical to pick them up?
Well, we were checking on them and making sure they were okay. We had to put them into a little box where we would look at the oxygen consumption. And we found that the yellow-bellied marmots we study in Colorado, which are, you know, groundhogs, woodchucks, are one of the 15 species of marmots around the world, one of the six species in North America, are the yellow-bellied marmots are the most efficient hibernators that anyone studied. They lose about 1 gram of body mass per day when they're in what's called deep torpor. So if it's cold in their burrow and they're a couple degrees above 0 Celsius, so a couple degrees above 32 Fahrenheit, they're burning about 1 gram of fat per day. This is for an animal that's about 4,000 grams, about the size of a big house cat.
Now, the crazy thing about marmots, they're up there at high altitudes a lot of the time, a lot of these species, and it's different than a ground squirrel hibernating because they're up there hibernating for a lot longer, or a groundhog hibernating. They're up there hibernating for a lot longer than anything in this region because it stays cold a long time in the mountains.
Yeah, and that sort of ties us back to climate change because over the past, 30 to 50 years, it's been getting substantially warmer at our Colorado study site, which is about 9,200 feet to about 10,000 feet above sea level. It's subalpine region outside the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory near Crested Butte, Colorado. And it's been getting warmer, in the spring at least, particularly, and the snow in many years is melting sooner. Now, what's interesting is we don't know the precise external cue. So, I mean, if you go into hibernation, you have to get really fat. And people are really interested in marmots because they can get obese without having health problems. And if you see them in the fall or late summer, they're really rotund. And they burn this fat. So they only burn a very little bit when they're in deep torpor, but they emerge throughout the winter. One of the fundamental questions in hibernation biology is do these animals that hibernate emerge to pee, or do they pee because they emerge?
So this is a key question.
It really is.
I wonder about this all the time.
An aging man, I'm changing my opinion on this. But, when they get up, they're burning a lot of energy. But when they're back down in deep torpor, they're not. So the duration of that hibernation period is going to influence whether they can survive or not, and that's going to be influenced by whether they have sufficient fat or not. So it's been getting warmer at our Colorado study site over the years, and the marmots are coming out from hibernation earlier. And this has led to, at least initially for over a decade, a population explosion in marmots. Then we had a really hard winter a couple of years ago, 2011, and we had a big population crash. We had another long winter last winter, good ski season, big population crash again. So the population is very susceptible to changes in duration of snow on the ground and duration of winter.
Steve Sullivan's here with the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. What about all this?
Well, I think those population explosions and crashes are intriguing when we look at them in the context of other species, things like snow geese that have also had a population explosion recently. And when you have a lot more animals than the environment normally does, they start to consume all the plants. And when they consume the plants, then this has what we call a trophic cascade. Everything else that relies on those plants and that intact soil and things starts to be impacted. And so even if groundhogs in this region do better because of global warming, everything else has the potential to do worse.
Now, up there in the mountains, is it possible that, if these marmots are coming out earlier and earlier, but there's still a lot of snow on the ground, do they not find enough to eat?
Yeah, in fact, it's really tragic. You see them come out through, in some years, 2 meters of snow, and they tunnel through it, and they can't see anything, and it's all bright. Often it's really fun if you see an animal emerge from hibernation because it comes out with a whole bunch of fleas that are trying to come out as well.
Really?
it's interesting. But they have nothing to eat, and sometimes they starve to death. So often when we see them emerge on these long springs, basically, where the snow doesn't melt until late May or June. Normally it melts in April and May. We see them starving to death, and we see them trying to eat tree bark and things like that, which is really not what they need to be eating. And we also see the predators, coyotes, eating them. So the marmots take more risks by going away from their little snow tunnels and to try to get something to eat, and they get killed. So these are sort of synergistic impacts that mean that a long winter is not necessarily good for the marmots.
So Steve was mentioning to me earlier that that February 2nd for Groundhog Day is a little bit early and unrealistic, certainly in the northern part of the country, to be seeing a groundhog coming out.
Pennsylvania, places around there and further in the south, they're beginning to wander around. Male marmots of all species, as far as I know, get up before females. So I like to sort of think about, why are they doing this? And it turns out that in our population of yellow-bellied marmots, the marmots can hibernate socially. They're a little more social than the groundhogs. But for every additional male in the social group, the first date of sighting is about 4 days earlier. So there's a lot of reproductive competition. So males of these species get up earlier. They start making sperm, spermatogenesis, and they start looking around for females. And sometimes we see them digging out females, you know, through 2 meters of snow and bringing them dried plants. It's really endearing.
Wow. That's
right around Valentine's Day, right?
A little after. A little after. We see it when we're seeing this in April, after tax day, but then going into May as well. But, now, you know, groundhogs also have been radio tracked around and followed, and the males get up earlier, and the males go dig up females and try to encourage them to mate.
Well, they're in danger if they get up too early. They should stop doing that.
Yeah.
Isn't it is it true that, like, when they get up, they can't eat for a week or something, that their stomachs are not do not have it going on or something?
Well, part of hibernation, I mean, hibernation is a fascinating set of adaptations, including they constrict and lose tissue in their intestines and stomach, and, you know, everything sort of atrophies. So they don't eat for a while, and they continue to lose weight after they get up. And if there's food to eat, you know, they'll begin eating after a while. If there's no food to eat, they'll continue atrophying it, but burning all of their fat. So often we see these animals getting up fat and healthy, but then they just waste away in front of our eyes because they're not able to eat anything.
So, Steve, do we have skinny groundhogs running around Chicago?
Chicagoland groundhogs are probably doing okay from the food standpoint, simply because we're kind of a heat island, and so the snow often melts a little bit faster and plants bloom a little bit faster. We also have a lot of invasive species that can tolerate some of the cold and can bloom very quickly and are also very, very common. And as long as it's things that are palatable to groundhogs, they're more or less doing okay. The real challenge for groundhogs in our region, I think, are, as Dan pointed out, predators like coyotes. We also have a lot of predators in the form of cars and also in the form of house building and tractor driving and things like this that at the very least disturb their habitats, if not actually kill the marmots themselves.
So I know both you guys have opinions on whether groundhogs and marmots are essential to the human existence or human environment. Steve, why don't you tell us where you come from on that?
Well, you know, whenever I say, hey, we need to conserve this species, the general public, they always say to me, well, what good is it? And frankly, on a groundhog, maybe I'd say, well, they taste just fine. Come on. But maybe from a more ecological perspective, you know, these guys are helping turn over soils and they're maintaining some of the plant communities in their areas. So they are an important part of the ecosystem.
You mentioned earlier something that's going on in China.
Well, the Chinese issues have to do with pikas, which burrow much the way that marmots do and other groundhogs. Pikas are actually related to rabbits. And there have been a variety of extermination campaigns of animals that are considered pests. And this doesn't just happen in China. There are counties in Illinois that have paid bounties for groundhogs because we see these kinds of animals as negatively impacting us. The Chinese one, since it's going on now, is particularly interesting to look at. We perceive these animals as pests. They dig holes and they destroy our gardens. But the problem is when we really look at it from an ecological perspective, they make the ground more porous. They prevent flooding. They eat plants that are otherwise toxic to some of our livestock. They help suppress weed populations. So when we really look at those ecological details, we find that every species really interacts throughout our ecosystem to make it a stable place that we like.
And what's the result of the pika exterminations in China?
Well, the hypotheses that the people studying that are looking at are that pika extermination will increase flooding, and it will increase desertification, and it will decrease the palatable plant species available for things like cattle and sheep grazing.
Daniel Blumstein, there at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab Marmot Project. Is something similar going on with what you're seeing with the marmot population up there in the mountains? Is this boom and bust cycle that they're going through because of climate change changing the environment there?
You know, it's not obvious. In some systems, it's really obvious. When you take something out, things change. Marmots, there's a lot of potential food for them to eat there. And where marmots are where they've been in the past. So they dig these burrows, they manipulate the land very locally in patchy areas, usually areas associated with subterranean rocks and which provide safety, I think, for them. We've studied this population since 1962, and we know that these little groups of marmots sometimes go extinct, and some of these groups we've studied since 1962 have been persistent the whole time. And extinction, local extinction, seems to be associated with risk, meaning that not food-related things. So we don't see them overeating the resources, nor do we see them really expanding into new areas per se, but they provide food for the coyotes and the mountain lions and other carnivores and meat-eating animals around there, and they do mix up the vegetation. The patches with marmots have slightly different plants than patches without marmots, and that's probably because of the disturbance they provide. The burrows provide homes for other animals as well. So I think that thinking about the loss of a species, not simply, it would be very sad to lose yellow-bellied marmots. I don't think they're endangered right now. While other species are literally endangered, yellow-bellieds aren't. It would be sad to lose them, but it's important to think that other animals rely on resources created by other plants and animals, and there's a network of life out there.
Right, so there's a whole system that's being supported that the marmot or the pika is part of, and when it disappears, it may not impact humans directly, but it impacts other systems that maybe humans and other creatures rely on.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm looking at are what we might call communication networks. Marmots give alarm calls, and I've done a lot listening to what they say and trying to understand what their vocalizations mean. But it turns out that their vocalizations have meaning for other species. Deer, for example, we have mule deer populations, pay attention to marmot alarm calls and respond to them and look around for predators if you were to play them back. If they hear marmot alarm calls. We're asking questions about what other species of birds and mammals respond to marmot alarm calls as well. Thinking about the communication networks, particularly alarm communication networks, gives us further insight into this sort of web of interdependence that species have out in nature.
My dog pays very close attention to squirrel calls.
Oh, yeah. Probably finds them and tries to eat them after that.
And that's his whole goal.
You know, you talked about some of the boulders that marmots use for shelter in the mountains, and one of the things that we've seen in Project Squirrel is that when people add concrete aprons to their back porches, oftentimes that allows chipmunks to invade habitats where they were previously excluded because feral cats were better able to prey on those chipmunks when they didn't have the refuge beneath the concrete slab.
There's a fascinating experiment, just think about this, done a number of years ago with pika again, this time up in Alaska, where this graduate student moved tons of boulders, and by doing so created a ribbon of boulders going out into a meadow and completely changed where pika were foraging in the meadow.
How cool.
Yeah, tons.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and we're having our monthly Ecomyth segment, and we're having a marmot groundhog hoedown, and we're talking about the effect that global warming has had on the fragile hibernation of the marmot. Kate?
So, Dan, you were giving me a lesson on marmots versus rodents versus groundhogs. Can you sort of put that into context?
Well, marmots are rodents, and groundhogs are one of the species of marmots, and all of these are squirrels. So marmots are, not all rodents are squirrels, but all marmots are squirrels. So rodents are the big group of organisms that include many families and order and many families of groups of animals, and marmots and ground squirrels and prairie dogs all are squirrels broadly.
And with Project Squirrel, one of the things we do is we use specifically gray squirrels and fox squirrels in most part of the country as a sentinel organism. They're, as Dan said, if marmots went extinct, stuff may or may not change a little bit. And similarly, if gray squirrels and fox squirrels went extinct, stuff might or might not change. But the activities of these squirrels, whether they're marmots or tree squirrels, can really tell us what's going on in a neighborhood. If marmots up in the mountains are squealing at each other all the time with alarm calls, then we know that there's a high abundance of predators. When gray squirrels in Jerome's neighborhood are squealing a lot, we know that he walks his dog frequently. And as the abundance of these squirrels change and as the diversity changes, that is reflected That is a reflection of some of the ecological changes that are going on in our neighborhoods. So even if these squirrels aren't directly useful to us, they are good indicators for what's going on all around us.
Now, is there any one green thing that we should do to help squirrels or marmots? Should we be trying to help out this population at all?
Well, from my perspective, you know, most of these are the ones that we're going to see are not endangered species. They're relatively common. But as I said before, they are indicator species. And so one thing we can do is go into the forest preserves. You know, Chicagoland has a great forest preserve system, as do many cities around the country. And be a responsible person enjoying those, and maybe even more. Go in and become a steward there. Help cut out buckthorn and remove garlic mustard and restore these habitats to something that is more than just a beautiful green place to hang out, but is a functional ecosystem within our human matrix.
And Daniel Blumstein, do you have any thoughts on what we should do, or should we do something to help marmots up there in the mountains?
Well, I mean, what we're looking at are long periods of evolution where species are co-adapted to the precise environments they evolved with. So when we start changing the environment, we start changing these co-adaptations, these evolved patterns of behavior. And this can have consequences, as we talked about. So I think anything you can do to reduce putting carbon in the atmosphere, ranging from walking to work or taking public transportation to eating more vegetables, is a good thing.
Daniel Blumstein is the professor and chair at the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UCLA. He leads the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab Marmot Project. And thanks also to Steve Sullivan, Senior Curator of Urban Ecology with the Chicago Academy of Sciences Peggy Notabart Nature Museum. Thanks a lot for joining us and talking about ground squirrels and marmots.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kate Sackman, thanks for another fun EcoMyth segment. I guess we our myth was it don't mean a thing to marmots, and I guess it do.
Climate change. That's it. All right. Well, happy holidays. Thanks.